And when you're trying to organize a unit, those workers are up against a lot of odds. And the fact is, I'm sure you've seen, Bezos and everybody else and governors who come against unions and just chilled and put the ice on organizing campaigns, there's no consequence essentially for it. So the ability to go out there and just organize a new shop is just incredibly, incredibly difficult. And I think if you looked at the stats on that, you would see it's almost, I wouldn't say impossible, but man, I mean, it's in the low percentile to get that done. And so the PRO Act would absolutely work to help that situation. And I believe that there's a ton of information out there. And if anybody isn't familiar with the PRO Act, definitely they should be jumping online. And again, there's a ton of good information out there to explain probably better than I could. But I just know that it's essential. It's essential if we're gonna continue to be successful.
That wraps it up for our week's episode of Labor Radio this Monday, every Monday at 6 p.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM. And we've been talking with Scott Oldham of the Painters District Council 5. Thank you, Scott, for coming on Labor Radio.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
All
Thanks,
right,
Scott.
I'm Jamie Partridge with Laura Wadlin. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Today, we're here with Terrence Hayes with Portland Freedom Fund, Liberation Literacy, and much more. How you doing today, Terrence?
Oh, good, bud. How you doing?
All right, man. Thanks so much. It's good to see you again. Yeah, it's been a long time. There's a lot of things going on. Can you start off just talking a little bit, just some background there with some of the organizations and projects that you've been working on?
So one of the things I'm working on right now with the Still in Prison Project, what I'm doing right now is just basically advocating that Oregon lawmakers and our attorney general don't uphold a racist, historically racist law of non-unanimous jury decisions. And let me be careful, not uphold it, but they're refusing pretty much to make it retroactive to the individuals that it affected. So in a sense that we know that it's unconstitutional, but they still haven't fixed it. So one of the organizations I work with, Portland Freedom Fund, who provides bail in Multnomah County for the BIPOC community, we're working with the Still in Prison Project at stillinprison.org to try to influence our lawmakers and our attorney general to do what's right and to give people who've been unconstitutionally found guilty of a crime the opportunity to come back and have a fair shot at a trial. So that's what I've been mainly focused on. We're still bailing people out. Liberation Literacy is still doing its best to affect incarcerated and formerly incarcerated men with political justice information and knowledge and hope that they fight the good fight when they get home. So for the most part, we continue to do that same work. I'm just looking for it. And I mean, I'm directly impacted by the whole non-unanimous jury decision because I had one. So this one is close to heart, and our Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum, was my judge at the time. So my aspect in this fight is not unique in the offense, but in unique in the parties that could affect change in the way that their decisions affected my life then and the way it can affect it now. So that's the grind mode, stillinprison.org. If you ain't heard about it, get on there, sign on to what we're doing and be a part of that change.
Yeah, that's great. Can you talk a little bit more about, as far as involvement, it largely folks who have experience like yourself and other friends and family members of formerly incarcerated and currently incarcerated people are plugging in this work and what that looks like, why that's really important to making that work happen.
Listen, I mean, at the end of the day, our lawmakers and our attorney general is voted in officials, right? Their responsibility is to do what the people decide is important, right? They don't have the freedoms to do it their way, how they want to do it. They're supposed to represent the best interests of the people. And so individuals like myself who've been affected by it, formerly incarcerated people, people who ain't never been arrested in their life, right? The reason that this type of thing is so important is because, one, we're supposed to be governed by our Constitution, right? No one is supposed to have the power or ability to step outside that and affect the law, the lives of Americans. And that law did, right? That particular law decided that despite the fact that you had the right to be found guilty by jury or peers with beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, that was fact. And this law said, well, we don't care about that, right? We understand that if there's one Black person on a jury with a particular focus, or if there's one juror who's not historically racist or prejudiced and really want to see the truth of it, they might decide that no, that person isn't guilty. No, they shouldn't be in jail because you said they did something that the evidence don't line up about, right? That was the intent of the laws and all that, and the jury peers, but they took that off the table, right? So this just is not a matter of guilt and innocence. This is a matter of constitutional rights and the responsibilities, right? And from a juror standpoint, if you're a juror, you go hoping and believing that your voice can save a life, right? Whether that means that it finds somebody guilty or innocent, you believe your voice and your opinion matters. Well, that law really doesn't give you that, right? So there could be two jurors who totally think I'm innocent and it wouldn't matter. Right. And that seems to be contrary to what we believe our system was set up to do, which it was. And so Oregon is totally behind. And even though the Supreme Court had to make a decision, we're still refusing to rectify that for the people. Now, there's a lot of amazing people and organizations in those places that are trying to affect change, right? For example, Ellen Rosenblum, our attorney general, I don't think she's anti the decision. I think she put herself on the wrong side of history by not standing against a historically racist law, right? And you cannot say that as our highest judge in our, you know, state, you can't say, yeah, I agree that it's historically racist and wrong, but I'm going to stand against it, the change connected to it, because I don't want to overwhelm the system, right? The system is not a real person. It does not feel. It is not an entity that lives and dies. It just exists because we give it power. We give it strength. But my life is real. The way that decision affected my children is real. Right. And so I'm looking at this and I'm saying there is mass numbers of Black men, especially who's been affected by this rule of law. And to say you're a progressive judge and not feel any burden to really deal with it when it's within your power, or to say, look, I think it should be dealt with, but I want the legislator to do it. I don't want to touch it. Right. I think at a point, I always felt like we were supposed to be past that when you had the ability to affect good positive change, that you did your best too. So I struggle because she's, you know, she's an amazing person. She's done a lot of good things. I don't know why she's staying away from this one so much, or refusing to handle it in a way that she has the power to. But I'm hoping maybe that as a whole, we can change her mind, right? She is an elected official, right? And she should represent the people. So if I can bring awareness to the people and get them to see, like, listen, everybody is affected from every stage. Because again, if you're a victim of a crime and you don't want the person who didn't do it to get in trouble for it, right? You're not looking to get innocent people. So you're trusting that the system will use its standards to find who's guilty. Right. And in this case, the system can't use its standard. So the victim, the so-called offended, and, you know, the regular civilian, every aspect of who we are as Oregonians is impacted by this decision historically. And now we all should stand up against it and demand the justice connected to it. Right. And demand that that people who've been found guilty unconstitutionally be given a fair trial and a fair assessment and a fair decision at the end of the day.
So for folks who wouldn't be familiar with the law, can you just say a little bit more about it, like the nuts and bolts of it and kind of, you know, where it comes from? And
So I think we're like 70 years into this law. So I think about 70 years ago, what ended up happening is Oregon basically had this big case where they're accusing this Jewish man of being like a gangster, and they couldn't find him guilty of murder. So what they did was is they basically went back and said, look, we, you know, we're running into these juries that's coming back 10-2, and it might be a minority owner, or it might be like a Jewish person, or it might be a Christian person, or it might be a more progressive person. We have all these people that could be in that jury that's saying, look, he might have done some things, but you don't have evidence for murder, and you simply saying it does not make him guilty, right? And so what the Ku Klux Klan was rising in power at this time in Oregon. And so what they did was they said, who was historically anti-Semitic or anti-anything that ain't white, right? So they said, well, this is how we're going to deal with this. We're going to create a law where you only need a 10-2 jury. That way, those random individuals that might not see things from a white supremacist disposition will be silenced, right? So this is how they kind of co-opted the jury process to fit their own dispositions in life. And so Oregonians have been appealing this and fighting this thing since its conception, but only recently did the United States Supreme Court finally decide to view it, along with Elisa Kaplan, who's an amazing professor of law at Lewis and Clark, I believe. But she's amazing. If you don't know about Elisa Kaplan, look her up, man. She's such a community-involved, amazing person in what she does. And so, anyway, she began a process of fighting this thing with some other people, and eventually it got into the Supreme Court and got overturned. And then immediately they had to make a decision about retroactivity, right? Will we look back at the people affected by this historically racist law? And will we say, hey, we recognize that and that ain't fair. Let's do right by you, right? And so the Supreme Court decided not to, 6-3, right? How do they look at it, admit that it's racist, and decide not to make it retroactive is crazy to me. So, but they did put in like a small footnote, like, oh, but each state can decide this for themselves. Well, we're only talking about Oregon at this point, because Louisiana had already did the work. So Oregon can decide for itself. And so now we fast forward, and organizations like Still in Prison at stillinprison.org is fighting now and saying, hey, we're Oregon. Like, what are y'all talking? Why is this still a decision? Our lawmakers or our attorney general need to fix this thing. And so that's the fight now, right? We're just looking for to at least create some standard of like, okay, if you can, because listen, there's tons of people who was found guilty. We didn't track this, for the record. We didn't track historically how many people was found guilty by non-unanimous jury decisions. So this whole concept of like we can be overwhelmed is not really true, because most people can't even prove it, right? So they will automatically kind of be barred because the courts didn't track it, right? Now, in the last, you know, 20 years, people start tracking it because we understood that it was a clear violation of constitutional rights. So in my case, my lawyer objected to the non-unanimous jury decision. We polled the jury. We know all the numbers. So there's a preservation there. So, you know, even for people who have clear preservation, they could come and say, well, listen, you clearly preserved it. Let's deal with you first, right? You've been home. You've stayed out of trouble. You're productive in our society. You're fighting a good fight, right? So here's our options. If 90% of criminal cases is settled out of trial, why do we all of a sudden think that'll change because people got retroactivity? It wouldn't. We would still have to process them. And more than likely, people will find some agreement with the district attorney's office and get it done. So that's where we're at. And right now, we're just almost damn near pleading with our lawmakers to get in there and make the change. I think for me, though, what I'm pleading is that the people demand that they do it, right? Because you want to move politicians, move the people, right? I'm looking now, and I'm pleading to the people to decide that they want to pay attention to this issue, and then recognize that there are thousands, you know, of Americans, right, that has been unconstitutionally convicted of crimes, man. And that's not, you know, that's not how it's supposed to be. And then for this law to be historically xenophobic, racist, right, anti-Semitic, and all those things, for us to be moving in this progressive way, we continue to say, and not automatically reject, you know, this concept that it don't apply to everybody. It's just astounding to me. So I'm just looking for people to recognize that there's individuals like myself who've been wronged, and we're just trying to get our day in court.
What can people expect, like, from now? It sounds like the ball's kind of rolling in a sense with some of the legal aspects of things. But at the same time, where does it need to go? For example, you know, there's this huge barrier in itself that Oregon inherently has this racist history that probably a lot of people aren't familiar with. And you mentioned how behind Oregon is and also has been. And that's also where, kind of on the national front, if you will, you know, this is something that's been largely unrecognized. And then maybe now people are trying to understand this more. There's been a lot of activity in the last year around, you know, the protests and everything like that, and seeing where that can also be a level of influence. So can you just talk about kind of what that landscape's looking like around that work?
Yeah, it's pretty cool, because once you start showing folks like, hey, this is not just about the black guy who's charged of a crime and could or couldn't be guilty, but this is really an all-around issue for our whole communities as a whole, and the different layers, people are responding really well, right? I rarely meet a person when I say, hey, did you know that you could have got convicted of a crime without a unanimous jury decision in Oregon? People are like, what? Absolutely not. That's crazy. That's not American. That's unconstitutional. So I'm really grateful for the response. I think that we have to continue to have these conversations, because I think, look, if we recognize something that's inherently racist and unconstitutional, I think that if we don't start making those things retroactive now, that as we progress and start addressing more and more of those type of things, then what will happen is they won't become retroactive later, right? And so you'll have this sense of, we can hide our offense in a legal decision, and there's nothing the offended can do, right? So I can't look back now and say, you were wrong, rectify it, because they saying I have no legal grounds to rectify it because I simply can make the decision not to. And so when I'm talking to folks, and folks are, I just want folks to get riled up. I love where we're going. If I understand right, the next phase is that we will be petitioning the Oregon Supreme Court to make a decision on the matter. And I'm really hopeful that our Supreme Court would decide to make it retroactive and create a standard by which to measure how it applies to people, right? And I don't think that's complicated. What I do think is complicated is maybe some political backlash connected to it, which ain't real to me, because this is my life. Like, I don't really care about how your politics go. But I think on all sides of the politics, when you're having real open conversations with people, folks are actually very responsive. So this is not like a Democrat-Republican argument. This is issue. This is an American issue. This is a constitutional issue. And so because it is, we can't let politics hijack that moment, because everybody is affected on all sides of the field. And it has to be about being an American and being offended under our Constitution and rectifying that offense for all Americans that it applies to, because it just does not apply to black or Jewish men. It applies to white men, Hispanic men, all women in every category, right? It just has worked how it was meant to work when it comes to individuals like myself. It's been very successful. And now that we recognize it and we're all demanding restorative justice, I think that we have to include the criminal justice system as part of what healthy restorative justice look like, not simply when a police officer kill an unarmed black man, but when they're able to also take their lives away with unconstitutional jury decisions. Because I lost 13 years of my life. I seen pretty much, I think, a month of my 20s on the streets, right? All of my 20s, which is essential developmental age for a young man, was taken from me because of unconstitutional jury decision. Now, no, you didn't kill me in the middle of the street, but the person that was supposed to grow and develop is dead, because now I had to grow and develop in a prison system that is not healthy for anybody, right? We just know it's a horrific system. And so now I had to grow and develop in that. And the person whoever I would have been without that unconstitutional decision is not there anymore. So I'm looking for people to realize that this is an all-around issue for all of us, and that if we don't stand against these type of decisions, they'll continue to do them as a whole.
So for folks just tuning in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland, and we're here with Terrence Hayes with Portland Freedom Fund and Liberation Literacy, talking about all kinds of old racist laws in Oregon, and of course, plenty of ones that existed all around the country for a long time, and how those things are changing, and people are paying attention to these aspects of things, and hopefully getting more involved. When you talked about all these people who were languishing in prison, it seems like also there's the whole economic piece people don't think about. A couple of things about that, where you got not only all this money that's just being spent for people to be inside instead of being outside, also in the sense that within the kind of COVID context, if you will, how jammed up everything is with so many people's cases. And so even where there's all these other really like strong push and pull factors around it, what does that look like?
Well, it's interesting because let's touch Ramos, right? Even if that applied to you and you're right in a perfect time frame for the law to apply to you, you have to remember that does not release you from jail, right? So not only am I taking a person from prison and then putting them in their county, which we don't know any kind of like COVID swamping that could be happening there, you know what I mean? But then I'm taking them and I'm deciding, like, even though this is unconstitutional, I'm not even going to let you go home and then start this process over. You're going to go sit in county, right? And then you're going to, if we decide to let you go, like, we, Portland Freedom Fund, bailed a young man out who was found unconstitutionally guilty, right? And the system is so messed up because it's almost like they just want to be quiet about it. It's so messed up that when he came back, they hadn't even showed what he was being charged with. It's such in disarray that he pretty much showed up and called us and was just like, hey, why am I back here? He didn't even know why he got, because they don't have to tell you in prison, right? I've been transferred, like, hey, where am I going? We're not telling you. Why am I going there? We're not telling you, because they'll say it's safety. So he was moved back to county with no knowledge of why, right? And then when we tried to bail him out, he didn't even show up in their system originally. So when I'm talking about like the chaos of the system and how this is not, you know, when they talk about overwhelming the system, this is not hundreds of thousands of people. This is one individual, right? Who the system is not even put together correctly enough to handle one guy, right? We should scream foul. We should demand that the system better equip itself. But instead, we're saying, well, since it's not properly equipped, we ain't going to put any more burdens on them when one person was. And so, you know, you just got people waiting, right? You got individuals that's in jail still who's found unconstitutionally guilty and don't fit the perfect time frame. And guess what? They got no hope. They're still doing time. I'm not even talking about individuals like myself who are home. I'm talking about individuals that are still incarcerated that this case affects, but because it didn't happen in 2000, you know, in 2020, right? It happened in, you know, 2002, and they're doing life sentences or whatever, that they had a hope, and then that hope was taken from them immediately, right? So you have an already messed up system, overwhelmed system, and then instead of doing what's right by people because of constitutional violations, you decided we're going to keep overwhelming them. We're going to keep funding and feeding money into the prison industrial complex with no true results coming out of it, right? And then this is a unique opportunity to stand with the people and not the industrial complex. We're going to reject that in fear of offending the industrial complex. So it's just like a cycle of nonsense that we keep getting back to. And finally, when there was like this point where we could have just dropped off and did some good stuff, we just like, no. You know what I mean? And we just turn in that corner again. So I feel really bad for the guys. I'm talking to guys every day that are affected by that decision and the pain and hurt that they have because of the hope that they had that are Supreme Court would honor their lives over a couple of dollars.
Well, you mentioned the whole cycle of bail there too. And that's another kind of interesting piece of it. That's also just totally wrapped up in kind of shrouded in mystery in some ways for people right. who I think are not familiar with what that looks like. Right. And there right. are plenty of people who are very familiar with that process and disproportionately people of color. Right. And can you talk about what that whole cycle is looking like with bail and what's going on?
Bail is so interesting because when most people think about it, it's like its intent was to ensure that classism didn't determine whether or not you can fight your case from home, right? That was the intent of the bail system. Well, it just hasn't turned out to work like that. In fact, it worked out differently because the rich are still able to bail themselves out because of the extremity of cost and bail. So the intention of bail is totally not being applied to how we're using bail. So then you have individuals like organizations like Portland Freedom Fund that are bailing people out. I have people that can get found not guilty or their charges drop and the city still keeps a portion of that bail. Now think about that. I am guilty. You arrested me wrongfully. I had to use my money or the money of others to be free. And when you find me not guilty, or you drop the charge, you still have the ability to take a certain portion of that bail. That's extortion, man. It's nonsense, right? But this is this circle of like intent versus application, right? And so the intent was to make sure that the poor and disenfranchised would have a way out, but it didn't work like that, right? They're now making bail so damn extreme, like you know you get arrested for a measure 11, it's a $1 million bail, $500,000 bail. Who has $100,000 or $50,000 laying around to bail out a family member, right? Who has that? So it's an unreal bail system. They actually create bails that no normal person, you know, no 99%er can afford, you know what I'm saying? And only a few percentage can truly afford it. So in the work that we're doing, we're trying to combat that system in a real way, which is not only to bail people out, but to help them in the process and not throw them back out to the streets that might got them in that situation. We're providing resources. We're helping with people pay rent. We're helping with utilities. We're helping with food, tickets, emergency situations. We're doing the work not only at Portland Freedom Fund, but at Liberation Literacy to affect those that have been affected by the criminal justice system. So cash bail is just a ridiculous concept of like exchanging money for bodies. That's slavery. That's a really wicked thing. And cash bail looks the same way, because not only do I have to put up this extreme amount of money to get out, but then you're going to put me on an ankle monitor. You're going to tell me where I can and can't go. Then you're going to tell somebody else they have total power over me. Now, I don't want to go back to slavery, shackles, and taskmasters, but I'm just saying it looks the same. And the prison industrial complex will always look like slavery from those that are a byproduct of it, right? All these things look the same, right? And we're still acting and normalizing them when they're historically doing the same thing it did, you know, 200, 300 years ago. And we still ain't progressed, as we throw that term around so much in this discussions, we haven't progressed towards seeing them for what they are and then really making changes in that field.
Right. And this whole profiteering off of people's freedom also kind of goes back to folding the system, where also, can you talk about where this bail money is going, and then what we can wrap up?
How the hell I'm supposed to know this bail money going? I imagine they're gonna plot it to like some supervision task or something. I mean, listen, it's hard enough for us to get the bail money back. Let's be clear about that.
Right,
like
right.
We literally have to fight or hope that they answer a call to get our money back, right? And we're cycling that money to affect lives. They don't have to answer for that. I mean, I imagine if they were forced, they'll say, oh, this is what the money connected to like the supervision. Maybe it goes into like a victim fund or like, but if I'm not guilty, why do I have to pay into a victim's fund? You know what I mean? But well, right. it doesn't matter. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter. I have literally no idea. We write checks for hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? We've literally spent $200,000 or $300,000 this year on bailing people out. I don't know where that percentage goes once they take it. And I've never seen the system feel no obligation to tell us.
Right.
Maybe maybe our listeners, maybe they'll get tired of the extortion and bail and decide that they want real answers about it. And if you track down an answer, you find me.
Yeah, right.
Facebook and everything. You find me and tell me how you did it. Cause I'm telling you, they ain't giving me none, but
right.
Facts.
We'll have to get another show on that sometime, for sure. Man.
Bring Amanda. If you do that, bring Amanda, man. Amanda love to talk bail with us. She go crazy on the bail system.
Well, let's figure that out soon. Thanks so much. Baby. Yeah, you've been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Big thanks to our guests and Prison Pipeline Collective member Karen James for editing and production. Free them all.
Want an impactful way to volunteer for KBOO? Believe in KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change? Then apply to be a member of the KBOO Board of Directors. Our KBOO board guides our strategic work and represents the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application. If you need a paper copy mailed to you, call the station or email applicationboard@kboo.org. That's one word, applicationboard@kboo.org. The deadline to apply is July 25th, 2020.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation.